Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanz on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, December 15, 2020. Some South Sudanese go through the painful memories of December 15 killings in South Sudan.
When the problem started in the midnight Sunday, I was in my house. Early morning like this, it was a mess, destruction, killing, chasing people away in their homes. So we run in different directions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Seven years after conflict broke out in Juba and spread to the rest of the countries, many families are still waiting for justice for their loved ones who died in the violence. Peter Chol Gwor lost five family members shortly after violence broke out on December 15, 2013. Paul says he wants justice for his loved ones and compensation for property lost during the conflict. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wood reports from Juba.
Many people lost their lives while others lost property. Hundreds of thousands of civilians fled their homes and sought refuge in either neighboring countries or at UN and church compounds. 60-year-old Reverend Peter Chol Gwor, one of the survivors of the violence, says he lost five family members shortly after the violence broke out in 2013.
When the problem started in the midnight Sunday, I was in my house. Early morning like this, it was a mess, destruction, killing, chasing people away in their homes. So we run in different directions until I reached the UNMISS in Tongping, near the airport.
Gwor says he had been living in his newly built house for just 3 months when the conflict erupted. He says he fled with nothing more than the clothes on his back. Today, Gwor has no house. The house he built was demolished and the trees he planted in his compound were all cut down. And now Gwor says someone has tried to grab his plot of land. Gwor's family still resides in a camp in Juba that the United Nations mission in South Sudan recently handed over to the government. Gwor says he has reunited with some family members who scattered in different directions when the fighting broke out. He says other family members were killed.
I lost a lot. My half-brothers, more than five, were killed in one day. In the same day of 16 evening. So
16 December.
16 December in evening. They were caught here in a low clinic. All were killed.
Barom Fal Koneng, another survivor of the conflict, says he was living in Juba's High Amarat residential area when the conflict broke out. A day later, Koneng says he fled to a UN camp in Tongping for protection. Koneng says he lost three family members during the first few days of fighting.
I have lost so many. My niece, her husband was killed together with his brother. That guy, he was an engineer, he just working in the company. But because of targeting certain people at that time, he was killed together with his brother. So I have lost so many people, but only just emphasize pure individual. And even my cousin, I lost him.
Chapter 5 of the revitalized peace deal on the resolution of the South Sudan conflict demands accountability for the crimes and atrocities committed during the fighting. It also demands that compensation be paid to the victims. Signed in September 2018, the parties are still struggling to implement Chapter 1 and 2 of the deal, which talks about power sharing and security arrangements. Koneng says unless victims like him see accountability is conducted, coming to terms with the effects of the conflict looks like a long journey ahead.
We need necessary justice, we need accountability. Those who committed a crime, they need to be held accountable. for the crime that they have committed all this time. And therefore, this will make us happy as the family members who have lost their beloved ones. But if those people are not held accountable, we cannot just write and say that let's make reconciliation.
Gwar is looking forward to compensation for the losses he incurred.
I lost the big house of 3 rooms, which can take all my family. But I'm now inside the plastic sheet house in the UN camp. In the midday is too hot and the night is cool. Coldest. This situation, we never know who will solve this problem.
A report released and published in 2018 by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, financed by the United States Department of State, estimated the conflict cost more than 380,000 deaths. The report says half of the dead died from diseases, hunger, and other causes exacerbated by the conflict. For VOA News, I'm Wak Simon Wudu in Juba.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok is commending the United States government for delisting Sudan from the list of countries that sponsor terrorism and allow Sudan to join the international community once again. Hamdok says Sudan will now be eligible to deal with global financial systems and open investment opportunities to many. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The announcement by the U.S. government officially removing Sudan from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism has been widely welcomed by Sudanese inside and outside of the country. Addressing reporters in Khartoum last evening, Sudanese Prime Minister Hamdok hailed the Trump administration for taking the step after nearly 3 decades of diplomatic isolation following the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Hamdok called the decision historic as his country will join the international community once again and have access to the world financial system. He says it has not been an easy job for transitional government to fulfill all of the conditions set by the U.S. government.
This is a historic day in its full sense. Our people have been under the list for more than 27 years. And today we are beginning first steps to return to our position in the international community, which we deserve it. Our people have never been supporters to terrorism. We are a peaceful nation full of hospitality, but this is due to the bad policies of the previous regime.
Hamdok says Sudanese banks now will be able to legally carry out transactions with other banks across the world without facing discrimination or fear. He says Sudanese nationals have suffered discrimination when traveling through international airports, but should now be a thing of the past.
We have been insisting to the world that we are a rich country. We don't need donations and gifts. This step will open up more investment opportunities in the country. It will also give our local and national investors to access the world. We expect to access technologies.
Muhammad Ali Fazari, a Sudanese journalist and analyst, says having Sudan's name removed from the list is not the end. Fazari says the transitional government needs to do more to address internal issues such as lasting peace, increasing local production, and economic reforms.
There is a lot of homework that must be worked on for both military and the civilian side, so that it is not an easy job for the economy to be recovered as soon as Sudan delisted from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism. It is still a long way to go for all the government components so that can reach an approach for these chronic economic situations.
Fazari says the move will be more beneficial to ordinary Sudanese citizens if the government uses this opportunity to encourage foreign investors and open job opportunities to young Sudanese.
People in diaspora, they can transfer their money very easily, more than ever before. The banking restrictions will be released, and many opportunities will be opened for the Sudanese people, not only the government, but the citizen in general.
Sudan was placed on the U.S. list of countries sponsoring terrorism in 1993. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A Ugandan opposition presidential candidate, Robert Chagulanyi, known as Bobi Wine, says the country's electoral commission should also invite President Yoweri Museveni to explain why the president continues to draw large crowds during campaign appearances despite COVID-19 regulations. The electoral commission had subpoenaed Bobi Wine and other opposition presidential candidates to explain why they continue to break COVID-19 regulations and hold large campaign rallies. Spokesperson for Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform Party says Wine feels the commission is applying selective justice.
The Electoral Commission did invite my presidential candidate, Honorable Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu Bobi Wine, to discuss a couple of issues. Of course, they've made allegations that it's going around flouting COVID regulations and so on. And we have made the point consistently. He does not invite people to come out in droves as they do. You know, his only crime is that he's popular. He's a popular candidate. He's magnetic. So wherever he goes, by the roadside, people stand with him and so on. But also, we are telling the EC to stop the double standard, because what's happening with Honorable Kyagulanyi, it's happening to all the other candidates too. Just that his is, you know, higher magnitude, the sense that there's many more people coming out and so on. But the incumbent, President Museveni, has crowds of people that wait for him by the roadside. They are walking in processions. Today he had a procession in the western part of the country. Police does not shoot at them. Police does not, you know, arrest any of them. It actually just protects them and so on. And so we've been telling the Electoral Commission, can they summon President Museveni too? We are not going to allow the double standards. What's good for the goods should be good for the gander. So tomorrow, Honorable Kyagulanyi is going to the EC to tell them those same things that we told them today, that look, I'm not the only candidate in this race. There's several others, including the incumbent. What's happening to me is happening to him too. So the next time you're calling me here, I want to appear with him too, because what you are accusing me for, Honorable Kyagulanyi, that is happening to candidate Museveni too.
How likely do you think the commission will do exactly what the Honorable Bobi Wine is going to ask them, that is to summon President Museveni to come before them?
Well, I can't answer that for them, but if it does not happen, then we'll tell them to give our candidate a break as well. Because if it's happening to the incumbent and several others, why are you persecuting my candidate? So if they cannot summon the incumbent too, then we'll tell them, please give our candidate a break.
Maybe the Election Commission is not aware that President Museveni is having mass rallies.
So they first told us that when we met them about 2 weeks ago, they said a number of them, for us, we are not on social media. So we don't know about these things. And we told them, wait a minute, you are the guys that came out and said much of the campaigning should happen on social media. So you're the superintendents of this whole process. What are you going to monitor if you're not, if you're saying you're not social media? But it was an excuse, of course. So even today they said, look, we have not seen or received any evidence to show that candidate Museveni is also doing what you're doing. But good enough, we were prepared. So we went with evidence. We showed them images and all of that, and then they acted like they were unaware of what's going on. But they obviously are aware, because by the time they summon our candidates, because of what they see on social media and so on, so they know what's happening with the other candidates. They're only afraid because he is their appointing authority.
I was talking to the Uganda Editors Forum about the new guidelines for accreditation of the media. Does the Honorable have any comment on that?
Yes, as a party, and of course our presidential candidates have been concerned too. We have spoken about this. The way the military is being treated, they are brutalizing them. A number of them actually still nursing injuries in hospital. Their crime is they're exposing the brutality of the police and the military of the regime.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya and Somalia cut diplomatic ties. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what improvements have you seen in your community over the past year?
I'm seeing infrastructures and services like water, electricity, at least now, alhamdulillah. Because like in 2 years back, we are getting water from the well. And now we have tap water.
Not so much in my community where I come from, not so much. But I only see people are venturing into business. People are learning business skills every time.
People those days didn't take their children to school. But nowadays, you can see that all people are willing to take their children to school. And also there's some development of the road constructions. There are also buildings around our places.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. And in our Tuesday Health segment, we look at the mass vaccinations in UK and US. The biggest vaccination campaign in American history began with healthcare workers getting COVID-19 shots around the nation. AP Washington correspondent Shaga Magani reports.
I'm feeling great.
Seconds later, New York critical care nurse Sandra Lindsay became one of the first to get the shot. With Governor Andrew Cuomo watching via video conference, Lindsay said she's relieved.
This is the weapon that will end the war.
In Louisville,
it starts today.
Dr. Jason Smith rolled up his sleeve and urged others to follow when the vaccine's more widely available. But there are fears many Americans don't want the shot or aren't sure. Health and Human Services Chief Alex Azar says the government will work to assure the nation that the shots are both safe and effective.
Getting vaccinated will help keep you, your family, and your country healthy and safe.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Still on COVID, pressure is growing in the European Union to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine after regulators in Britain, the United States and Canada gave green lights in recent days. Coronavirus cases are soaring across the continent with extended lockdowns announced in Germany and Netherlands. For VOA News, Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Britain called it V-Day, or Vaccination Day, December 8th, the start of its mass coronavirus vaccination programme. The rollout began in major hospitals and is now being expanded to local clinics. About 800,000 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine are being distributed, with several million due before the end of December. Dr. Nikita Kanani is Medical Director for Primary Care in Britain's National Health Service.
Less than a year ago, we're treating the first patient with COVID, and we are now able to give a vaccine. The team has been incredible.
People over 80, the clinically vulnerable, and frontline health and nursing home staff are first in line. Doctors say by inoculating these vulnerable groups first, the pressure on hospital intensive care units will ease. So, how did Britain gain the head start? British regulators insist full safety checks were carried out. June Rain is chief executive of Britain's Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency.
So there should be no doubt whatever that this is a very safe and highly effective vaccine. It will help us turn the corner.
But in polls, half the British public have safety concerns over the vaccine. The World Health Organization's chief scientist, Soumya Swaminathan, says it is vital that governments communicate clearly.
And the more open and transparent we can be, the more likely it is that people will have the trust and the confidence and would not only want to take the vaccine, but would also be patient and wait for their turn.
With Britain, the United States and Canada having now approved the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, pressure is growing on the European Union to do the same. Approval is expected by the end of December. Angela Merkel is German Chancellor. She said, we want to do this in a very coordinated fashion and show that everyone has the same kind of access. That access will not be available to billions of people around the world. Aid agencies accuse rich countries of hoarding the vaccine. Anna Marriott is Health Policy Manager for Oxfam.
9 out of 10 people in poor countries are not going to receive a vaccine next year and possibly for years to come.
Scientists say the world will not get back to normal until there is a global rollout of vaccinations. Dr. Stergios Mostios, a molecular biologist at the University of Northumbria, recently spoke to VOA.
Somewhere between 70 and 80% of the population worldwide will need now to be vaccinated.
That would require billions of doses of vaccine and is likely to take many months or years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
K Kenya has dismissed Somalia's accusation of interfering with its internal affairs after Mogadishu overnight cut diplomatic relations with Nairobi, dropping relations to a new low. The tensions come after Kenya hosted leader of Somaliland, a self-declared breakaway state inside Somalia. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya says it will not take diplomatic actions against Somalia after its severe relations with the East African nation. Speaking in Nairobi Tuesday, government spokesman Cyrus Oguna said his country will not take the route taken by Somalia.
There are, you know, discussions, you know, taking place or going on to ensure that the relationships are normalized for normal socio-economic, you know, activities to be able to continue as they were before. So there is a committee that has been put in place to be able to look at those issues that are, you know, coming in between these two neighboring countries that have got a lot of, you know, history between the two of them to be addressed.
Somalia's Minister of Information, Osman Dube, announced the end of diplomatic relations with its neighbor and said Kenya's ambassador and his staff must leave the country within 7 days. Somali federal government sees Kenyan citizens as peace-loving people and love peaceful coexistence with the people in the region. He says the two countries enjoy historic relationships that are built on good neighborliness and working together. But today, the Kenyan leadership is working to divide the citizens of both nations. Somali federal government has taken this decision to respond to Kenya's open political and internal interference in our sovereignty. Dube says relationships between Kenya and Somalia are at an all-time low due to differences over Jubaland, a federal state led by Ahmed Islam Adobe, and a maritime dispute which is at the International Court of Justice. Kenya insists it does not interfere with the affairs of any country, including Somalia. Kigen Murumbasi teaches international relations and security at the Strathmore University in Kenya. He says with the closure of embassies, the two countries will find it difficult to talk on many issues.
Diplomacy is what oils relations between states. When states want to interact with each other, they use diplomacy through the embassies. But now when we see this happening, it makes bureaucracies longer. It actually severs ties, and it makes probably negotiations for issues such as mutual trade or issues of common interest for the two states. It eliminates that platform where the two countries can actually sit together and work on a formula which is productive for both. So here we are seeing once countries sever the diplomatic ties, it probably means that they're not willing anymore to engage diplomatically on issues of mutual interest.
Murumbasi says Kenya should continue engaging with Somalia, which will be beneficial to the stability of both countries and the region.
Kenya should continue to try and engage diplomatically with all the actors involved and not really try and de-escalate or try and get into this diplomatic fight as a reciprocal measure. But we very well know that Kenya as an anchor state in the region still plays an important role. And it should continue to try and be engaged in Somalia and try to see that the peace and stability is actually achieved. This is because of the close proximity that Kenya has with Somalia, and it's for the mutual interest that peace and stability is achieved in the region.
Somalia is preparing for parliamentary and presidential elections, but the preparation has been hit by disagreements over the election committee and dispute resolution delegates. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, Sean. 7 years ago today, fighting between government forces and rebel leader Riek Machar's bodyguards broke out in the capital, Juba, touching off a nationwide conflict that lasted more than 5 years and caused more than 300,000 deaths. Many South Sudanese families are still waiting for justice for their loved ones killed in that violence. Many others who lost property also want compensation. 60-year-old Reverend Peter Chual Guar tells this program that he lost 5 family members in 2013. He says he was forced to flee with his family from his newly built house when the conflict erupted. He says that house was demolished and his family still resides in a camp that UNMISS recently turned over to the government. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok praised the U.S. government for removing Sudan from the list of countries that sponsor terrorism yesterday, saying the move allows Sudan to rejoin the international community. Hamdok hailed the Trump administration for taking the step after coping with nearly 30 years of diplomatic isolation during the rule of President Omar al-Bashir, who the military ousted in 2019. Hamdok says it has not been easy for the transitional government to fulfill all of the conditions set by the U.S. to be delisted. He said the Sudanese people have never been supporters of terrorism. And finally, Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Bobi Wine says the country's electoral commission should call on President Yoweri Museveni to explain why the president continues to draw large crowds during campaign appearances despite COVID-19 restrictions. The electoral commission had subpoenaed Wine and other opposition presidential candidates to explain why they continue to break COVID-19 regulations and hold large campaign rallies. A spokesperson for Wine's National Unity Platform Party says Wine feels the commission is applying selective justice. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Yala Kitautu by Victoria Ole.
Yala Kitautu. Kitautu,
yala,
kitautu,
yala,
kelli ni najere,
yala,
ni najere,
yala,
kelli ni najere,
yala,
ni najere,
We've been listening to Victoria Ole with the song Yala Kitautu. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, vehicles, and phones. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you are in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
أكثر من 20 سنة ناس موتوا كتير دم كوبوا كتير أولادنا أبوهاتنا أخواتنا